the late exam, you can still do that. I assume almost everybody here doesn't need to do that, but just in case, you can sign up over there. If you have to leave a piece of paper for me for your schedule, that's over there too. Now, I want to pick up where we were last time. We were discussing the two kinds of proteins, those that are made on the free ER and those that are made on free ribosomes and those that are made on the rough ER. Now, I just want to say one thing before I go on. I do misspeak sometimes, and that's the trouble with the tapes. And I just discovered that there was one thing I said backwards on the tape a couple of lectures ago, so that's on the corrections page. So you're going to need handout 6 for this. If you don't have it, it's over there in the middle of the bench. That we said that a ribosome is making a protein, and either it can attach to the ER, and in that case, the ribosome will continue to make protein that will enter the endomembrane system, and we discussed last time how things move through the endomembrane system. Alternatively, the ribosome can remain free in the cytoplasm. And this is the big divide at the top of handout 6A from last time. And what we want to consider now is how it works. What is the mechanism that determines whether the ribosome will take the right or the left? And this is diagrammed on 6B in detail in the so-called signal hypothesis. And that's what we want to talk about today. Now, the basic idea is that the messenger RNA and the ribosomes get it together and they start making protein. This is step 1 on 6B. This is the nascent growing chain. This is its amino end. And it is a property of the protein itself that determines whether the ribosome will attach to the ER or will not. The protein can contain a sequence which says, take me to the ER, and that is called a signal sequence or a signal peptide. Now, it's not always on the amino end, but it often is, and we'll explain it this time with it on the amino end and then explain how it can be somewhere else. First, let's consider what if there is no signal peptide. If there is no signal sequence, then this ribosome just continues to make protein. The ribosome remains unattached, and the protein is released into the cytoplasm. Now, that's not drawn on your handout. We'll just draw that aft to the side. No signal peptide or sequence. Ribo and the protein stay in the cytoplasm. And that's this fork over here. And we described last time that the proteins from here go to all the parts of the cell that are not part of the endomembrane system. So proteins either stay in the cytoplasm, go to the nucleus, go to mitochondria, etc. But if there is a signal peptide, then, as shown there in step 2, the so-called signal recognition particle, or the SRP, binds to the signal peptide. And so we've drawn that here. We've symbolized the signal recognition particle as a triangle. Now, the binding between the signal peptide and the signal peptide recognition particle, we should write that here. Yeah, that's all right. Serves two functions. First of all, it prevents further translation. So it blocks translation so that we won't make any more peptide until the peptide has gotten over to the ER and can get into the ER. Second of all, this particle is going to help the ribosome protein combination stick to the ER. So it's going to do two things. Now, before we leave that, why is it called the signal recognition particle? Well, you understand the signal recognition part. But this is a particle. This is a complex machine containing both RNA and protein. So it's a ribonucleoprotein particle. Ribonucleoprotein particle, not a protein or just an RNA. Now, this is a complex structure like a ribosome or a spliceosome. Another molecular machine. And as we said, it serves two functions: to stop translation and to help the ribosome and the protein reach the ER. So how now does the signal recognition particle help the whole complex get attached to the ER so this protein can enter? So if you look at the next picture, we've drawn a little bit of the ER. Now, this is a bilayer, and it has two proteins in it, which we've drawn here. Now, before we go any further, we have to talk a little bit about the topology to be sure it's straight. The ER, remember, is a series of flattened Saxon tubes. So if here's a piece of the ER, which I'll draw as a tube. This, of course, is a cross-section. The ER is like so, with the lumen or space in the middle. What we're looking at here is just a little piece of this membrane. Because what we're going to look at is how things get across this membrane into the lumen of the ER. So this is a blow-up of the part in the box. This is a little piece of bilayer. And of course, where's the lumen of the ER? And where's the cytoplasm? This would be the lumen side over here, and this would be the cytoplasm. Now, you notice we have two proteins here. This protein here constitutes a pore or channel, and the protein is actually going to wiggle through that channel into the ER. And this is usually called the translocon. Some people use the term translocon just to mean the channel or pore, and some people use it to mean the whole complex. But it's usually clear from context which one is meant. Now, the signal recognition particle is not going to take the ribosome directly to the translocon. It's going to take it instead to this other protein, which is sometimes simply called the SRP receptor. Now, you may notice that we've drawn it so it matches the shape of the SRP down here with the ribosome, etc. Now, people who like more colorful language call this the docking protein. Now, there's another feature here that's important. You notice that the channel is filled in here. The channel is closed when there is no protein in it. Now, that's necessary because you don't want things leaking out of the lumen into the cytoplasm or vice versa. So the channel is actually blocked. Like most channels, it's gated. That is, it can be opened or closed. And it's actually the entry of the new growing chain that's going to gate or open this channel. So that's here step three. What about step four? Now, what we've drawn as step four is actually quite complicated and involves multiple steps. Several different things happen. So let's draw our picture again. Here's the bilayer with the docking protein and the channel, or pore. At this point, what happens in step four is the signal recognition particle falls off. It's going to be reused to capture another peptide and bring it peptide and ribosome. And now, the ribosome and the growing chain have been transferred, so to speak, to the actual translocon. So the peptide starts to grow inside the channel. It makes a little loop. We'll talk about that a little bit longer in a minute later. This is the amino end, the starting end of the peptide. Now, you notice that now the channel is open. It's been gated by the presence of the peptide. In this picture, there is a space between the ribosome and the translocon. There's really no space. That is that the ribosome is flat up against the bottom of the channel so that it prevents things from leaking out or leaking in. And the only thing that moves through the channel or pore is the growing peptide. Now, in addition, what have we done here? We've released the SRP. We've attached the ribosome to the translocon, and the chain has started growing. And this process actually requires energy, which comes from splitting GTP instead of ATP. Now, what's going to happen as the peptide grows? Which end does it grow from? The peptide grows from this end, the carboxyl end, so amino acids are added on this end. And as the amino acids are added, they push the loop of protein further and further through the pore. And so that's why in the next picture, we've drawn it again. Here we've properly drawn the ribosome flat against the bottom, but now the protein is much longer. The amino end is still right down here. This is the signal peptide. And then here is all the rest of the growing protein. Now, this process continues, and what does it take to push the protein through the core, the translocon, the pore? This is called co-translational import because the protein is going in at the same time as it's being made. The alternative is to make the protein first and wiggle in it afterwards. And that does sometimes occur. But here, the protein as it grows is pushed through the pore, and the energy of protein synthesis is sufficient to push the protein through. Now, in this case, let's consider what happens if the protein actually goes all the way through. That is, the protein is finished and pushed all the way to the other side. And that's what happens in step 6. We finish translation. So now the ribosome and the message can be recycled. They actually separate and can be recycled. But now the pore is empty, and the protein is over here. Now, maybe we should have drawn an intermediate stage. I push the protein all the way through. All the rest of the protein would be on the lumen side, and it would be anchored by the signal peptide in the pore. Except in our next picture, I've closed the pore, and I've got the protein out of the pore. How did I do that? People think that the pore is actually gated in two different directions and in two different ways. If the pore is like this, we've been talking about the idea that you somehow close it on the top or the bottom so that things don't leak out when you're not using it. But in addition, it's thought that the pore opens sideways. And this allows proteins to go out of the pore into the lipid bilayer. Now, the reason that makes sense is the signal peptide itself is probably what triggers the opening or gates the sideways opening. Now, the signal peptide is hydrophobic, and therefore it remains in the membrane. Once it slides out, it will stay there. Now, we haven't quite finished. Most of the time, the signal peptide is removed because there's an enzyme in the lumen of the ER, which recognizes a sequence in the peptide itself and cuts the peptide, leaving the signal peptide behind. So the signal peptide is generally degraded, And the whole peptide now is released as a soluble peptide inside the lumen of the ER. Now, I want to explain not just a little bit more about the detail of how the protein wiggles through, and also to consider the possibility, how do you get a transmembrane protein? The protein we just made is a soluble protein inside the ER. How do you make a transmembrane protein? And that's on the next handout, for today, the one for today on 6-7A. But before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions. Yeah? GTP is split to provide energy, probably to move the ribosome protein combination and to start transport through the pore. If you're interested in more details of this, Becker has many of them. Yeah? Is the ribosome ever attached to the ER? At this stage, the ribosome is probably attached to the bottom of the translocon. But after translation finishes, the ribosome comes off. Before translation happens, before it starts, that's over here. In the very beginning, in the very first step, translation starts before the ribosome, so to speak, has made up its mind. The whole point of this is that there's not one set of ribosomes attached to the ER that makes one set of proteins and three ribosomes unattached that make another set of proteins. There's just one pool of ribosomes. And the ribosomes start making the protein, and if the protein has a signal peptide, then the whole shebang goes to the ER and attaches. So in this model, if we look now again at our handout, on 7A, we've drawn the process, but we've left out, except in the very first step, we've left out the ribosome, we've left out the translocon, etc., to make it a little easier. So on the top, we just have the bilayer. Again, it's a blow-up of a little piece of the lumen, of the membrane surrounding the lumen. And we have the ribosome, and it's starting to make a chain, and this is the amino end. Now, as we showed in the previous picture, the protein does not wiggle through amino end first. It apparently makes a loop. I drew the loop this way here and that way before, but in both cases, this is the amino end, and you form a little loop. So the carboxyl end is down here. And as the protein grows and gets longer, more amino acids, more peptide is pushed through the membrane. Now, of course, this takes place inside the translocon until the signal peptide slides out. But we're leaving out the translocon to make it simpler. And this little thing here is the signal peptide. Now, so the protein gets longer, as we drew it before. And in the case we're talking about here, the entire protein ends up on the lumen side of the membrane. And then, usually, signal peptidase cuts off the peptide, and it folds up. And the signal peptide is degraded. Now, how do you get a protein that is locked in the membrane? But maybe before we do that, we should do a model of what just happened. Suppose this is the membrane surrounding the ER. So I'm going to draw it this way. This is the lumen side. This is the cytoplasmic side. So here is our peptide. And this is the amino end, and this is the signal peptide. So what we think happens here is the protein forms a little loop, and the loop goes into the membrane. And since, of course, I don't use GTP, et cetera, I have to cheat a little. I use my hook. So as the protein grows, the growing end gets longer and longer and longer until the entire protein, except for the signal peptide, is inside the lumen. Now, the protein can stay like this, anchored by its signal peptide, but usually the enzyme signal peptidase, which is inside the lumen of the ER, comes along, recognizes the appropriate site in the protein, and cuts off the signal peptide. And now this protein can fold up in the proper shape. Now, how does it work to make a transmembrane protein? It's a variant of the same process. And let's consider first a single-pass protein. We know that some single-pass proteins are this way, carboxyl on the lumen side, what will later be the extracellular side. Some of them are inserted this way in the membrane, with the amino end in the cytoplasm, and some are inserted this way with the carboxyl end in the cytoplasm. And there's more than one way we think to do it, but I'm going to explain one of the ways this is possible, and they're all variations on what I just said. So if we go back to the handout and we look at the second case, again, lumen, cytoplasm. Suppose we have a protein which is a little different than the previous one, in that the previous one, except for the signal peptide, which is hydrophobic, the entire peptide is hydrophilic. So the entire thing passes through the pore. But suppose we have a protein that has a hydrophobic stretch somewhere in the middle. And this is long enough to form a transmembrane helix. Then what will happen when this part gets to the membrane? So if you look at your picture here, when the hydrophobic part gets to the membrane, like the signal peptide, it can gate the channel and it can slide out of the translocon. So this section anchors the protein in the membrane and becomes the transmembrane section. Now this protein, the way I've drawn it, is anchored at two ends by the bihydrophobic sections. But remember, signal peptidase the enzyme inside the lumen. That enzyme can again recognize this sequence and cut off the signal peptide. And if we do that, we'll have a transmembrane protein. Now, because of the way we did it, which end is where? This was the original amino end. And so when we cut here, this will be the amino end in the lumen and the carboxyl end in the cytoplasm. Now, let's see how that would work with the sponge model. So here we have a protein which has a signal peptide on the amino end, but it has a hydrophobic section in the middle. So what will happen this time is, again, the signal peptide forms a little loop, and that starts the growth of the peptide through the protein, through the membrane, until we get to the part where the hydrophobic section is, and that will lock the protein into the membrane. And so the rest of the protein that is made, instead of going through the translocon, is made into the cytoplasm. And now the only thing that remains is for signal peptidase to come along and cut off the signal peptide. And now we have a single-pass transmembrane protein with a locked in the middle of the membrane by its hydrophobic middle section, and its carboxyl end is in the cytoplasm. However, we know there are proteins that are the other way around. If you look at your handout, they're called type 1 and type 2. You don't have to remember which is which, but when you go and you read papers, sometimes they refer to a type 1 protein, and for reference, you'll know which of these it is. Now, how do you get a protein the other way around, with its amino end in the cytoplasm and its carboxyl end outside? I shouldn't say outside, in the lumen, on the luminal side. So that's the third case on your handout. And the big secret this time is, where is the signal peptide in the protein? The signal peptide is not at the very beginning. So when the protein starts being made, there's no signal peptide in this part. It's only down here somewhere that we encounter a signal peptide. And at that point, the signal recognition particle comes along, combines with the signal peptide, carries everything over to the ribosome, and we start moving through the channel. So it's this part here stays on the cytoplasmic side, but when we get to the signal peptide part, here's the signal peptide, that starts a loop going through the translocon, just as before, and this part is going to be pushed through the translocon. So the picture looks like, here's the signal peptide. And if we keep going, we'll end up with a single pass protein with its amino end in the cytoplasm and its carboxyl end on the other side. So let's see how that would work. This time, the signal peptide is not on the end, but in the middle. This is the signal peptide. This is the amino end, which I've labeled, but the signal peptide's in the middle. So this part of the protein gets made, then we get to here, we finally make a loop. And pull through the rest of the chain. Now, do we want signal peptidase to do anything this time? Do I need the scissors? I don't. This signal peptide doubles as a transmembrane sequence and a single peptide, signal peptide, and we don't want to get rid of it, so we just leave it there. There's no sequence here cut by signal peptidase. Now, both of the cases that I talked about here give you single pass proteins, either one orientation or the other, carboxyl versus amino. How do you get a multi-pass protein? This is the final example, which is on the handout, how you get a multipass. Well, before we draw it, maybe we should just look at the protein. The secret to it is that you have a signal peptide, and this could be in the middle or it could be the end. But after the signal peptide, you don't just have one hydrophobic section. You have multiple hydrophobic sections. So what's going to happen is we're going to make a little loop and go into the membrane until we lodge here. This section is going to trap the protein in the membrane. But then the next hydrophobic section starts a new loop, and we grow a new loop until the protein looks sort of like this. Now, that's drawn on the handout, so let's go through it one more time. Here we have the signal peptide, starts the usual loop. But then we have a hydrophobic section. So when that gets pulled through, the protein stops moving. But now we make some more, and we have another hydrophobic section. And when this hydrophobic section gets there, it starts a new loop. Now, what's going to happen depends on how many hydrophobic sections you have. If there's no hydrophobic section here, then this whole chain will be pushed to the other side. If there's a hydrophobic section here, then it will lodge the protein in the membrane. So the number of loops you get, the number of luminal and cytoplasmic domains, depends on the number of hydrophobic sections. And usually, as we said before, the signal peptide cuts off, signal peptidase cuts off the signal peptide. Now, if this is the way the protein were, let's say, which is the way it is on the handout, since we cut off the signal peptide, we'd end up with a protein that has three transmembrane sections, amino end on the outside, carboxyl end on the inside. Now, everything you can think of happens. There are proteins with both ends on the luminal side, there are proteins with both ends in the cytoplasm, and there's one of each. All of those happen. and they all happen by variations of this scheme. Now, a word about the terminology. The signal peptide is, all of these are hydrophobic, but the signal peptide is special in that it binds to the SRP or the SRP binds to it, depending on how you look at it. All of the others appear to be equivalent. In this picture, the second section acted to stop transport through the membrane, and the third section, the one after it, restarted transport through the translocon. So in a situation like this, this sequence is usually called a stop transfer sequence, while this one is called a start transfer sequence. Now, transferring means transfer through the translocon. What's interesting is that stop and starts are apparently equivalent. That is, what determines whether you're a start or a stop just determines who you, depends on who you come after. The next one after the signal peptide is a stop, the one after that is a start, etc. Now, how do we know all this? We know what does what because by genetic engineering, we can make recombinant proteins. We can make proteins that have no signal peptide and see what happens. We can take out one of these start-stop sequences and see what that does to the next guys in line or the topology of the protein. And all of that stuff has told us, for example, that start and stop sequences are really equivalent, and it's just the order that determines which one you are. All signal peptides are start-stop sequences, but not all start-stop sequences are signal peptides. Now, to give an example of how you do this, normal GFP is a cytoplasmic protein. But if you make a recombinant gene so that the GFP has a signal peptide on it, then it ends up secreted from the cell. Because it enters the ER, signal peptide is cut off, and it's like the top case. And proteins inside the lumen often end up excreted or secreted by the cell. Now, while we are on the topic of the ER, I want to talk briefly about other things that happen in the ER besides having proteins made on them. But before I do that, let me ask, are there questions about any of this? Yeah. All of this transport across is occurring in a translocon. But at some point, this protein, the hydrophobic sections slide out of the translocon and lock the protein in the membrane. Now, the question of whether all of these are in the same translocon or not seems to be unsettled. People don't seem to know. Once the protein is put into the membrane, does it move? If the protein is not attached to some type of cytoskeletal structure, then it can move laterally in the membrane. Yes?
Is it allowed to form the tertiary structure in the membrane?
Yes. So one of the question about tertiary structure, each of these sections, you can see that a loose section clearly folds up. But even a loop like this takes on some preferred three-dimensional conformation, depending on its amino acid sequence. And in fact, one of the things that happens in the ER is that peptides fold up. That's one of the major things that happens. We've already said two of the big things that happen in the ER. Signal peptidase removes the signal peptide if it's on the end most of the time. And proteins fold up. Now, to fold up, they need proteins called chaperones or chaperonins. These are also called heat shock proteins. Or HSPs. Because these proteins were discovered because cells that have been subjected to heat shock make a lot of them in an attempt to refold their proteins. But these proteins are around all the time to help ordinary proteins fold. And as you learned last semester, these don't determine the final shape of the protein, but they help it get there. And there are two basic types of chaperones, which are distinguished by their mechanism and by their approximate molecular weight of either 60,000 or 70,000. And some of them act, form a kind of barrel, so that folding can happen without bumping into things. And others act in other ways. And if you're interested in the details, you can look them up in the text. And there's a major chaperonin found inside the ER, and it's called BIP. I forget what it stands for. It's by something, but I don't remember. Now, there are two other enzymatic modifications that happen in the ER. Some proteins have disulfide or SS bonds. All of those proteins are either part of the endomembrane system or extracellular. And the formation of the disulfide bonds occurs with the help of an enzyme, and that enzyme is inside the ER. So only sections of the protein that are inside the ER can form disulfide bonds. Now, similarly, we've referred to glycosylation. The enzymes of glycosylation are also inside the endomembrane system, so that's why only sections of protein that pass through the endomembrane system can get glycosylated. Now, there are actually two kinds of glycosylation or sugar addition called O and N. And that refers to the side chain atom that they're added to. In the case of N-glycosylation, the sugars are added to the end of asparagine, the side chain of asparagine. In the case of O, they're added to the hydroxyl side chain of serine or threonine. Now, O-glycosylation actually happens in the Golgi. The enzymes that do it are all in the Golgi. But N-glycosylation happens in two stages. And it starts in the ER and ends up in the Golgi. So some of the enzymes are in the ER, and some, for later steps, are in the Golgi. So this one. So inside the ER, proteins fold up. They get disulfide bonds made, if they're going to be any. The signal peptide is usually removed, if it's on the end, and they start their glycosylation. But while we're talking about the ER, what about the outside of the ER? So everything we've been talking about here, all these things, happen in the lumen of the ER. But there are enzymes that are attached to the membrane whose catalytic portion is in the cytoplasmic domain. And these proteins actually catalyze reactions in the cytoplasm. But many of them produce things that don't necessarily stay in the cytoplasm. There are two major classes of these enzymes in human cells that are important. Some of them do detoxification. And some of them do phospholipid or membrane lipid synthesis. Some of the enzymes for detoxification are on the outside of the ER, and some of them are in the peroxisome. Now, what we mean by the lipid synthesis is lipids are made from precursors that are soluble, and the precursors are in the cytoplasm. But once the lipid is assembled, of course, it's lipid. The chain part is lipid-soluble. So let's blow up our membrane again. If this is the cytoplasmic side, all the new lipid molecules, all the new phospholipids, are stuck into this side. So they all come from the cytoplasm and go on the P side of the bilayer. But we all know that there's about an equal amount of lipid on each side. And the reason for that are those enzymes we've called flipases. Which allow the movement of phospholipid from one side of the leaflet or bilayer to the other side. And depending on which enzymes are present, a lipid can be equally distributed on the two sides or more on one side than the other, as I think it's problem 1-2 has it. Now, what happens to proteins that don't fold properly? It turns out that a reasonable number of proteins don't actually fold correctly, even in normal cells. And in cells that have mutations, you get sometimes very large amounts of misfolded protein. So what happens to that protein? That protein is actually shipped out of the ER to the cytoplasm, probably back through the translocon. It's not clear how it happens. But if you have, then, if you have misfolded protein, it goes to the cytoplasm, and from there it goes to a large protein structure called a proteasome. Some proteins are destroyed in the lysosome, especially things from the outside, but many cytoplasmic proteins are degraded in the proteasome. It's a large protein structure, and it breaks the proteins into short peptides. Now, in order for a protein to go to the proteasome, you have to add to the protein. You have to add a small protein to the protein to be degraded using an enzyme. And the protein that you add is called ubiquitin. So there are a series of enzymes that recognize the misfolding and add multiple ubiquitins to the target protein. And that sends it to the proteasome, and it gets degraded. Now, I think a recent Nobel Prize was actually awarded for this discovery, and I forgot to link it into the web, and if I remember, to the notes, if I remember, I'll do it when I get home. That is, back to my office. Now, there's another feature of this which is worth mentioning. The proteasome probably primarily can be looked at as a way of recycling the garbage. It breaks the proteins down, and then they're broken down to amino acids, and you can recycle the amino acids. But the proteasome serves another function as well. These short peptides, some of them, actually go back into the ER and are put on the surface of the cell. So it means that a cell has on its surface a selection of pieces from the proteins that it's making. And this, as we'll talk about how this happens later when we get to the immune system. But this means that the immune system can tell from the outside what proteins a cell is making. And the reason this is important is if the cell is doing the right thing, then those proteins are normal cellular pieces. But if a cell is, say, infected by a virus, then it's making new proteins, and pieces of that protein will be on the outside, and with luck, the immune system will recognize this new strange piece of peptide and kill the cell. So we'll talk more about that when we get to the immune system, but this seems to be one function of the proteasome to provide the pieces that identify what the cell is making. Now, before we leave the ER, I realize there's one thing I forgot to say. We talked how to make proteins that are soluble in the ER and that are transmembrane proteins, both single pass and multipass. But we mentioned a while ago that there's another class of protein which is linked to lipid. So there's a lipid anchor. And then the protein is like this, or it's like this. The kind of protein that's on the cytoplasmic side is usually made on cytoplasmic ribosomes and then attached to a lipid. The protein that's on the extracellular side is of the membrane is generally made in the ER. And then the protein is sent to the plasma membrane looking maybe something like this. But once the protein gets into the plasma membrane, an enzyme cuts off or into probably not the plasma membrane, but in the lumen of the ER, this section of the protein is cut off and attached to a lipid. So these lipid-anchored proteins, which have their protein on the luminal or extracytoplasmic side, get made in the ER and then hitched to lipid. Now, I want to leave the ER and move on to the Golgi, but first let me ask if there are questions about the ER part before we start up with the Golgi. Yeah. When the lipid is... The lipid-anchored protein... Generally, the lipid... The question is how it's attached. The protein is attached to the hydrophilic part of the lipid. We want to move to the handout with the Golgi, which is the other side of today's handout. Now, we know from the labeling experiments that we talked about last time that material that is made in the ER proceeds generally to the Golgi. A few things stay in the ER, but most things move on to the Golgi. And the way that works is that a vesicle buds off from the ER membrane, and it could carry either a soluble protein, which was inside the lumen, or it carries transmembrane proteins that were inserted into the membrane, and of course it carries lipid. So this vesicle pinches off, and this is always, again, a coated vesicle, but the coat is not clathrin. It's a different protein. And so this forms a vesicle, and the vesicle goes and fuses with the Golgi. So we have on the bottom of the handout a diagram, two models of the Golgi, but for this part, they're actually equivalent. That when you look at the Golgi, it consists of these sacs. And if the ER is down here, the Golgi is a stack of these sacs. This is one stack. This is a sac. And there doesn't necessarily three of them. There could be many. But it has three regions. The part that's the closest to the ER, so there would be a vesicle from the ER to here. This is called the cis face, or the forming face of the ER. The other side is called the trans face, or the maturing face. And the stuff in the middle is just called the medial section. So the Golgi has a cis part, a medial part, and a trans part. Now, inside each part is a characteristic set of enzymes, and we've drawn them here with these little symbols. Those are the enzymes that modify proteins as they pass through the Golgi. We know that protein comes from the ER and joins the Golgi. And not only soluble proteins, but also transmembrane proteins. And we know that this material passes through the Golgi and out the other side. What we don't know exactly is how it gets through the Golgi, as we'll explain. Now, the Golgi is associated with a bunch of transport vesicles. And we'll explain their role in a bit. Because there are lots of vesicles, the stuff on the cis end, which includes the cis part of the Golgi and the vesicles around it, is sometimes called the cis-Golgi network. And the stuff on the other end, which is the top, the far part, and the vesicles associated with it, is sometimes called the trans-Golgi network for the other part. Now, I have a model for this today, and in keeping with the sort of general theme of bread, I should have brought a bunch of pitas. But I'm still eating the bread from the freeze fracture. So I decided I wouldn't get any more, and instead I have a different model, something like this. So the Golgi, this would be one stack. There are usually more stacks in it, but this is one stack. And it has, if the ER is down here, a cis part, a medial part, and a trans part. Now, what you see in that picture is what you get if you just slice it this way. Slice it in half and look from this side. Now, we know that stuff enters from the ER and passes through. And these proteins that pass through and get modified are usually called cargo. And then we have these modifying enzymes that work on the cargo. And the question is, how do you do it? How do you move the cargo through so that first it meets this set of enzymes and some change occurs, and then it meets this set of enzymes and other modifications occur, and then it meets other enzymes and modifications occur? How does that work? And there are two basic models of how it works, and that's why there are two pictures on your handout. Now, the simplest model, in a way, is the one on the left, which is called the stationary model. Now, the idea there is that the sacs or cisternae of the Golgi stay put. So what happens is a vesicle comes from the Golgi, from the ER, carrying material, cargo, and that fuses with the Golgi. And then modifications occur inside the first sac. But then vesicles bud off, carrying the cargo, and they fuse with the next sac. So the cargo gets modified by the second set of enzymes. Then the cargo goes into a vesicle and moves to the next sac, and so on. Now, there are sort of three aspects to this model. One is the direction the vesicles go. In this model, the vesicles are going this way. They go from one to the next. But the other model, this is a stationary model. In the progressive model, or the cisternal maturation model, the vesicles are actually going the other way. So which way the vesicles go is sort of issue number one. Now, to keep it straight, in this model, how are the vesicles going relative to the bulk flow of cargo protein? Cargo protein moves from the cis side as it gets modified up to the trans side and then to its target. So you think of this as being the forward direction. But the vesicles are going backwards. So this is called retrograde motion of the vesicles. Now, in the other model, you'd think they'd call it forward movement, but instead they call it anterograde. Now, the second thing is what's inside the vesicles. Now, before I explain that, I have to say a feature about this structure that we didn't mention. I said that the enzymes that are present in each part of the Golgi is characteristic. A certain set of enzymes is always found in the cyst side, and a different set of enzymes is found in the medial sacs, and a different set of proteins and enzymes, these are the modifying enzymes, is found in the trans set. And the characteristic enzymes of each part are referred to as marker enzymes. We'll find a more general use of this, that an enzyme that is always found in a particular cell compartment is used as a marker for that compartment. When you fractionate a cell and you find the part that has that enzyme, you know you've got the part that came from that organelle. Now, we know that there are characteristic enzymes then in each section. According to the progressive model, what happens is one cisterna doesn't just sit there, one sac doesn't sit there. Each sac gradually changes composition and turns into the next one. And this one turns into the next one, and so forth. So the two other issues are not only which way do the vesicles go, what's in them, and do the sacs move. So in our first model, the sacs stay put, the vesicles move anterograde or forward, and they carry the cargo to be modified up to the next stage. But in a progressive model, it is the sacs that move. So what happens is the sac on the trans side forms vesicles. In effect, it disintegrates into vesicles, each vesicle carrying proteins to go to their destination. So this one actually falls apart. But in the meantime, there are vesicles coming from the ER, and they all join together, and they form a new sac. But you have to remember, all the enzymes, the same enzymes are always found in the trans and the cis. So how are we going to do that? Remember, the vesicles are going the other way. So instead of the vesicles carrying the cargo forward, they're actually carrying the enzymes back. They are reclaiming the enzymes and moving them back one. So when this sac fell apart, some of the vesicles contained the modifying enzymes, and they fused with this one. So this one got a delivery of the proper trans modifying enzymes. But at the same time, some of the enzymes in that used to be in the top in the second one were put down to this one, and some from this one went to that one. So the vesicles are going retrograde, reclaiming enzyme and putting it back in place. And they're constantly spinning their wheels to keep the enzymes in place. So what would happen with time is this sac would mature, fall apart, some of the enzymes would be brought back to here, these enzymes would be brought back to here, and these enzymes would go in a new sac, which formed from the ER, and so on. And eventually we get a new one, and all the old sacs will have moved on. So this is the right-hand or the progression model. And in this case, the vesicles are going retrograde. What is in them is the modifying enzymes, not the cargo, and the sacs move as opposed to staying straight. Now, we really don't know which it is. There is some evidence favoring one, some evidence favoring the other, and some evidence favoring a third model. Yeah?
How do you prevent the sacs from shrinking?
The sacs don't shrink because they're always getting new material from the ER, always moving up. Everything is always going on to the next guy, but some of this material is going to go back to the ER ultimately. Yes?
Why is it so difficult for scientists to figure out?
Why is it so difficult to figure out? Because how are you going to follow a protein through here? A particular protein? It turns out that it's not so easy to do, but people are working on it. And now that we have GFP labeled protein, probably we'll get to the bottom of it. GFP-labeled protein allows you to follow newly made protein through the cell naturally without having to intervene. But let me just say that what is probably the answer is that in some cases, vesicles carry enzymes this way. In some cases, cargo is carried this way. And it may vary from time to time or from cell type to cell type. So these are two are not inconclusive. Yeah?
Is there more modifying enzyme than there is cargo?
Is there more modifying enzyme than cargo? Well, I would say at any one moment, I don't know. But remember that the modifying enzyme is an enzyme. So a little bit is used over and over and over again, but cargo is moving net through. So if you say, I guess you don't need that much enzyme to modify successive waves of cargo. Yeah. Where does the trans-modifying enzyme come from originally? Well, remember that this is the proverbial molecular chicken and the egg problem. That at least in modern, for the last few million years, every cell has come from another cell. So how do you set the whole thing up in the first place? Is your real question, because everything comes from the previous, how do you get this stuff? And I can't tell you the answer to that, except that when a cell divides in two, probably it gets a little bit of each of the Golgis. It gets a mini Golgi, which presumably has some of it. Now, new protein, your question about what is there more of cargo and enzyme, at some point, each enzyme was once cargo. So in order to get an modifying enzyme here, you had to make it in the ER and ship it up to here, but then it stopped here. It either stopped here, or it went all the way to the end and came back. It may be that the protein that works inside here requires modifications that only happen here. And in that case, the protein has to go all the way to the end and then be shipped back where it will work. But things are constantly being pushed back, which is why things don't shrink. So whatever the model is, probably a mixture of all of them, what I want to look at now is the primary function of the Golgi, in addition to doing modification, appears to be to sort or direct proteins to the proper destination. Some of the proteins that finish from the Golgi are going to go to the plasma membrane. Some of them are going to be secretory vesicles, which go to the plasma membrane and wait for a signal. And some of them are going to go to other parts of the endomembrane system, like back to the ER, back to an early part of the Golgi, or to lysosomes. And how does that work? So we're going to focus on lysosomes. And that's the top part of 7B. Now, you asked, why is it so hard to figure out how this works? One of the problems is that most things that interfere just screw up everything. But one of the reasons we know how enzymes get to lysosomes is because of a disease, actually several diseases, when they don't get to lysosomes properly. And from that, we have figured out the function of the missing protein. So if we start from the ER, the question now is, how do you get the collection of acid hydrolases into a lysosome? So if you start with the ER and you make a bunch of proteins, and a vesicle comes off the ER, I've drawn two proteins in here. There would actually be many, of course, but I've drawn two. And one of them is meant to be a typical hydrolase, destined for lysosomes. And this is a protein which is destined for a default vesicle. Meaning, this is a protein which is going to end up delivered outside the plasma membrane. Now, of course, there are many hydrolases, many proteins that end up outside. They'd all be in here. Now, what happens when that vesicle fuses with the Golgi, with the sac on the cis side? It delivers the two proteins, or the two kinds of proteins. Now, the point is that these are destined for different places. How does the cell know, so to speak, where to send them? We said that proteins contain their own localization signals. Each of these proteins had a signal peptide, or it wouldn't have gotten to here. But this protein has an additional localization signal that says, take me to a lysosome. And what that actually is a sequence or patch on the protein which is recognized by an enzyme that adds mannose-6-phosphate. Or M6P. So what the patch really says is add mannose-6-phosphate. And that will be enough to send it to a lysosome. So in our next picture, we've actually, the enzyme has acted, and we have mannose-6-phosphate attached to our hydrolase. Now what is going to happen is proteins with different destinations cluster in different parts of the Golgi, probably because they match up with receptors. In this particular case, in one section of the Golgi, there are receptors for mannose-6-phosphate. Many, but we've only drawn one. So the proteins that are destined for the lysosome cluster in that part of the Golgi attached to those vesicles. And all the proteins that are going to go into a default vesicle and reach the surface cluster in a different part. And so then the vesicles bud off the Golgi. One vesicle containing the various hydrolases and their receptors, and one containing the proteins destined for the plasma membrane. Now in 11 and 12, we have what happens next. If we just consider the protein, not the hydrolase, but the protein that's going to go to the surface. This vesicle is going to fuse with the plasma membrane, and the protein is going to end up outside. And one of the reasons I've drawn this here is that in one of the diseases that affect lysosomal enzymes, there's a mistaken processing. And the enzymes, instead of going to a lysosome, in fact follow this pathway and end outside the cell. And we'll talk about that in detail next time. But let's first follow what happens, how does this hydrolase normally get to a lysosome? So this vesicle buds off, and it now fuses with an endosome. Remember endosomes, that's where it's mildly acidic, and protein ligands and receptors tend to separate. And that's what happens here. The receptor for the mannose-6-phosphate and the hydrolase separate into different parts of the lysosome, of the endosome. Now, what happened when we drew this before? When we talked about LDL and LDL receptor, we drew something very similar because receptor-mediated endocytosis dumps its stuff into the same place. So coming from the inside, coming from the outside, these combinations reach an endosome. And now you sort out the pieces. Now, what happened with LDL? The receptor came from the plasma membrane. At this point, it separated. The receptor separated from the LDL, and the receptor went back to the plasma membrane. Now, here something very similar happens. This receptor is going to go back to the membrane from which it came. Where did it come from? Came from the Golgi. So, in fact, they're going to get a vesicle budding off here. But instead of fusing with the plasma membrane, it's going to fuse with the Golgi membrane, and it's going to recycle this vesicle, this receptor, so it can catch more enzymes and do it again. And these numbers, by the way, match up with the equivalent numbers on the handout for receptor-mediated endocytosis because the steps are equivalent. Now, what about this vesicle? Things are going to butt off this end. Where is this vesicle going to go? If this is a hydrolase, this is going to go fuse with or turn into a lysosome. That is, it's going to become much more acidic, and we're going to activate the enzyme. It's going to meet some substrate and do its thing. Now, this is what normally happens. In each part of the Golgi, different groups of proteins gather, form into individual vesicles, and go to their target. In the disease we're going to talk about next time, what happens is the sorting fails and things end up in the wrong place. And we'll explain how that works and what we think we can actually do about it.